Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, the 1st of December, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And so for the 1st of December, we are doing a show about good news with the PPD. This year, Philadelphia's homicide clearance rate has hovered near 90%, a number the city has not seen since 1984. And if you're wondering what that is, that's the number of cases or murder cases that the PPD has identified a suspect. Not necessarily made an arrest, but has identified and charged a suspect. Detectives are making arrests faster. Technology has exploded. And for the first time in a long time, it is genuinely harder to get away with murder in Philadelphia. But those numbers, they don't tell the full story because hundreds of killings that took place, particularly between 2021 and 2023, the worst years of the gun violence surge, they still have no arrests, which means thousands of Philadelphians are still awaiting closure. So today we're going to break it all down. We're going to look at what's driving these record high clearance rates, how technology has transformed investigations, and also what's still not working that has left so many families in the dark. We'll have a wonderful group of panelists. We have Ellie Rushing, criminal justice reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We have PPD Deputy Commissioner Frank Venor, who leads the homicide unit. And we'll also hear from someone who's still awaiting closure on the death of a family member. We have lots to come. And our question of the day for you, our listeners, is this: do you feel safer in Philadelphia with crime down and clearance rates up? Why or why not? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave those comments in the chat.
It's also a chance today, I think, to step back and look at what it takes to solve a murder case. Because
we think we know
because we see shows like Law and Order and Dateline, et cetera. And I'm sure you get a glimpse with those shows. But we get to hear from someone who actually has worked those cases and oversees people working those cases, and to give us a real boots on the ground sense of what it takes to bring a killer to justice in the city of Philadelphia. Again, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. But first, as always, a trio of local news stories, starting with some breaking news this morning out of the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals just down the street from us here on Independence Mall. In a unanimous decision, a panel of Third Circuit judges said Alina Haba is disqualified from serving as the top federal prosecutor in the state of New Jersey. Let's rewind. Haba is a former personal attorney to President Donald Trump. She was installed as interim U.S. attorney for the state of New Jersey earlier this year, but never confirmed, and that's key, never confirmed by the U.S. Senate. The Trump administration attempted to keep her in place anyway as, quote, acting U.S. attorney. The Third Circuit rejected that move and upheld a lower court ruling. Of course, this is major news, not just for the state of New Jersey, because their top federal prosecutor's office is in disarray right now. It's not just news for them, but it's news potentially for other states where the administration has taken similar steps, tried to install acting U.S. attorneys who have never been confirmed by the U.S. Senate.
Yes. And again, the U.S. Constitution requires that U.S. attorneys be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And according to reporting, Haba is unlikely to get confirmed because two senators in New Jersey, Cory Booker and Andy Kim, oppose her nomination. But process here matters. So they're trying to go around that process. And I have to underscore that the judges on the Third Circuit said that the administration's argument and their actions to install Haba should raise a red flag because it would allow the Justice Department to circumvent the law and effectively allow anyone to hold a U.S. attorney position indefinitely. So this is not about politics. It's about process. And by the way, two of the three judges on that Third Circuit panel were appointed by Republican presidents. So this is an apolitical, you know, ruling here. But when justices say this is a red flag, you do pay attention.
There is a court higher than the U.S.
Which is the U.S. Supreme Court.
Circuit Court of Appeals. It's the U.S. Supreme Court. So I guess we'll see if they agree, take up this issue or just sort of let the ruling stand. Go ahead.
Second story, Philadelphia Police Department is forming a new unarmed auxiliary police unit made up of, get this, volunteers. That's according to the story published in the Philadelphia Inquirer. This new unit would be unarmed. They would not be able to make arrests and would not be assigned to typical police duties. Instead, these auxiliary officers would help the PPD maintain law and order by providing crowd and traffic control during big events, possibly coming up in 2026, you know, like the 250th July 4th celebrations, the FIFA World Cup matches, things like that. And this unit would engage with the public and would be the eyes and ears for PPD officers on the ground. And they would basically do much of what academy recruits typically do while they are in training. Other cities like New York, they've had these auxiliary officers. Cities like Baltimore and some townships use what are known as reserve officers. But for me, Avi, when I saw this story, it stood out to me because this is not a surprise because, you know, they have the argument has been made that the PPD officers have too many duties.
Right.
And there are some things that could be offloaded to civilians or unsworn officers to kind of alleviate the burden and let our PPD officers actually do police work.
Right. And of course, the cost often of staffing, you know, street fairs and stuff can be prohibitive when, you know, you're forced to hire a certain number of
and pay the overtime.
Yeah. So, I'm curious also, I guess, from the PPD's perspective or like how the plainclothes officers feel about, I guess, exporting some of these duties, given that they were the ones making the overtime pay. It wasn't addressed in the article, just occurred to me just now. But but you're right. It's interesting. And they have these forces in other cities. So it's not a revolutionary concept, even though when you first hear it, you're like, wait, there's going to be unarmed auxiliary officers and their volunteers. Are like, wait, that's
volunteers?
Real? But apparently it is real. It happens in other cities. So I guess that, you know, makes it feel
and
a little
we
safer.
We do have a staffing shortage in Philadelphia. They've had a hard time recruiting new officers and
yes,
a lot of folks
true.
Have been retiring. So this could sort of solve that problem as well.
Yeah, fill
and
some gaps.
And it's unclear, of course, when the rollout of this new auxiliary unit would happen, but they're saying hopefully sometime in 2026.
Speaking of sometime in 2026,
A
new restaurant slated to open in May in Center City will have its menu determined by the results of a reality television competition. What? Is this real? Apparently this is real. Story here from Philly Voice. The restaurant and show is called Recipe Philly. Mm. The eatery will be a high-end casual spot on the corner of Broad and Arch Streets. Contestants on this reality television show will each pitch a dish for the menu of Recipe Philly, a dish that they make at home, and then there will be an elimination-style competition to ultimately select the dishes that Recipe Philly serves to its customers. A menu created by a reality television competition. The TV show is in production. It has not yet been picked up, but reportedly there are talks ongoing. But they're filming this thing right now. There's been a casting call. People have auditioned to get their dishes onto the menu of this restaurant that I guess is going to exist in real life and you can go to.
Yeah, this could either be beautiful and a genius endeavor or complete disaster.
Big disaster potential.
Potentially. But we don't know. I mean, the line of folks waiting outside of the convention center for the audition was crazy long. So clearly people are very interested. But the problem is, you know, they got, I mean, you don't know what kind of restaurant this will be.
Well, it's going to be, I assume that the menu will be totally incoherent. It's just going to be a bunch of different,
And the interest,
which is fine by me, I mean, I'm just saying.
One of the dishes that was highlighted, the only dish that was really highlighted in the Philly Voice was a hot dog topped with grandma's coleslaw recipe.
Sounds good.
And it could be good, but this is supposed to be high-end casual. So,
well, but she didn't win the competition.
I know, but
we don't
I'm
know
just
if it's
saying.
Gonna,
but I'm just saying, the variety of things that could likely be pitched. You don't know. You don't know what the rhyme or reason is.
Well, that's
is
why you have
be.
To trust that the judges have good judgment and they'll pick the good dishes.
And it's 100. They're going to start with 100, whittle it down to 30. It's going to be interesting.
Very. And, you know, usually a restaurant is like the vision of one person, the chef,
yes,
right?
Yes, the chef.
This is like you flipping it on its head. It's the wisdom of the crowds. We can recruit, you know, 1,000 people to give us their best recipes. and, you know, the wisdom of the crowd will create the best possible menu. I think that's a solid logic.
I think it's interesting. I definitely, they have to design the restaurant once they figure out the menu. So everything is sort of reversed.
I can't wait to go.
And you put this note in here, and you put this note in here that the winners will earn cash prizes and they'll be able to eat for free. For at Philly Recipe or Recipe Philly, as long as their dishes remain on the menu.
I wish I had competed.
That's kind of cool.
I wish I had competed. That's a great prize.
What would you make?
You know, maybe a little PB&J.
Oh.
I will say, if this works, the next iteration will be that reality TV show contestants will put their best dishes
See,
up.
See, I would put my mac and cheese
yeah,
up.
Bethany
my
Frankel versus, you know, Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, and we could have a restaurant based off of that. Anyways,
yeah.
Transitioning to the big topic today, which is clearance rates. On homicide cases in Philadelphia, they're way up. We want to know why, and we're going to find out on the other side of this break on Studio 2. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. When a murder takes place in the city of Philadelphia, chances are authorities will charge and arrest the person they believe to be responsible. Now, that sounds like a nothing statement, right? Well, in recent years, it wasn't always true.
In fact, as recently as 2022, Philadelphia's clearance rate, the number of people charged with murder divided by the number of people killed, was below 50%. It has since soared to nearly 90%. In the last few years, bottom line, your odds of getting away with murder in Philadelphia have gotten a lot worse.
But why? That's a question at the center of today's show. So let me introduce our guests. We have Ellie Rushing, a criminal justice reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer, who has covered this topic extensively. Ellie, nice to have you back on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me again.
And we also have Frank Venor, who brings a perspective from inside the Philadelphia Police Department. He is a deputy commissioner in charge of homicide investigations. Frank Venor, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're glad to have you.
And we would love to hear from all of you in the audience. Do you feel safer in Philadelphia with crime down and clearance rates up? Do you have any general questions about how murder investigations are conducted here in Philly? This is your chance to give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, how you doing? Drop a comment in the chat.
And before we go to the inside of what happens at the PPD, Ellie, we wanted you to give us a 30,000 foot view of this. You've been tracking this. I want you to paint a picture of how big of a turnaround this has been that we've seen with regard to clearance rates when compared to just a few years ago.
Sure. So, I mean, this is a significant improvement. Between 2017 and 2022, the homicide clearance rate hovered around 50%. It bottomed out in 2021 around 41%. And this year, like you said, Avi, right, it's almost at 90%. And again, right, when we're looking at the broader picture, when it bottomed out in 2021, that was when Philadelphia was experiencing a tremendous gun violence crisis. People were being shot and killed. I mean, between 2020 and 23, there were, you know, more than 1,500 homicides in the city. This year, we're also seeing a significant reduction in violence overall. And so that has helped the clearance rate with seeing fewer people killed.
Yeah. Frank Venor, I wanted to have you fill in the blank here. The biggest reason that the clearance rate for the Philadelphia Police Department has gone up over the last 3 years is what?
Well, depends on who you ask. You get a lot of different answers there. But I think there's multiple reasons why. And I could go into a few of them.
Okay.
You know, in my 36 years with the police department, I spent a lot of time in investigations. And we did a lot of things the same way, right? This year, we have 203 homicides as of this morning. Way down. We're down 16% from just from last year. And that was down significantly from the year before. As Ellie said, we had some really bad years where homicide was high. So investigations needed to change. We've seen that. In 2022, I asked the then police commissioner to form a group to handle non-fatal shootings. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the way we handled non-fatal shootings before that was they were divisionalized. So whatever detective was available at that division went out and handled the case. So I got to tell you that every case, every division handled them a little differently. And some of the cases cleared some cases, some didn't clear many at all. So our citywide average was about between 9% and about 15% cleared.
For non-fatal.
For non-fatal.
For non-fatals, but I'm going to tell you how this relates.
Yeah.
So many of those non-fatal shootings ended up with other shootings following them and murders in retaliation for the first shooting.
So same people involved.
So it's all connected. Yeah.
This person's group shoots at this person's group, and it goes back and forth until either everyone is eliminated or we somehow make an arrest and interrupt it. What happened now was in 2022, we moved into our new building. We had a lot more room. So we put the shooting investigation group, we formed them up in February 2022. We put them and co-located them with homicide.
Mm.
So same room. Different,
proximity. Yeah, close proximity.
Different commander. Yeah. But now they're working the cases like a murder. Okay? And those cases where we were getting a 9%, 15% clearance rate citywide, they're over 40% cleared.
So you feel like you're getting to the root of the problem a lot quicker, and that's preventing future
these back
homicides.
And forth. Yeah.
They're back and forth. So shootings are down, homicides are way down, and the one motive that was really driving our motives, retaliation, is down over 50% in murder. So the
and that's something you guys categorize and track, whether it was a retaliatory shooting.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Interesting. Wow.
And so there were, and Ali, you, in your reporting, you listed a bunch of things. And Frank, we're going to get your take on some of the things that you found out in your reporting as the reasons why the clearance rate has been able to shoot up over the past couple of years. Could you break that down for us?
Sure. I mean, right, arresting more shooters leads to a reduction in violence. And when detectives have more time to solve the case in front of them, they can go back to some of those older cases. You know, a case this year solved from 2022. That person is out there. They could cause more violence. And so that time factor is really big. There's also, you know, a really big investment in technology this year. Mm. Actually, over the last 3 years. So even this year, there are twice as many real-time crime cameras that are on our streets.
So these are cameras 7, that are just posted up all around the city.
Yeah.
And I mean, they are incredible. I mean, they can zoom in on the tattoos on your neck, on the soda can label on the ground. I mean, they can catch everything. And there's 7,000 of those. That doesn't even include all the SEPTA cameras, all the just like private Ring cameras. And so detectives having access to those videos everywhere is really important to their investigations. We also have, the department has invested in license plate readers, so they can track the getaway cars that are leaving the scenes of shootings. They can get evidence from those cars. And they've also just invested in other technology like cell phone tower data, phone extraction devices that just give them the story behind every murder.
So I want to talk about the technology side of this, Deputy Commissioner Vanor, because I'm curious. I imagine in some cases, the cameras, the readers, the cell phone evidence allows you to identify who did it, right? But I'm curious if it's actually more common that you already kind of have an idea of who did it. This technology allows you to build a case that you feel like you can bring to trial because now you have really good circumstantial evidence instead of squishy witness evidence. Is that more common than sort of helping you identify like the whodunit side?
Sure. So I was a sergeant in homicide. I'll go back. I was a detective in a division. I was a sergeant in homicide. The way we solve cases were witnesses. Yep. And a statement from the offender. Now, in this world, both of them could go away on you. One, your witness could not be available when the time for court. Two, you know, we've had people challenge some of our old statements and then becomes problematic for the prosecutor.
Yeah.
All right. So what happens in when you talk about technology is that evidence is not going away. Mm-hmm. It's there forever. Digital evidence, our digital forensics, our video evidence. Now every officer is walking around with a body camera on.
Yeah. Mm.
That's evidence we're collecting. So if I have you as a suspect and I find out you were stopped, I'm going to go back to the officer that stopped you. And you know what? There you are. You're in the car we're looking for, wearing the same shirt.
So all of a sudden that you're building a case on sort of like what could be unreliable witness testimony. Now you can say, even if it's unreliable, I got this whole other thing over here, this whole other tranche of evidence, and it really can't be disputed.
That's right. That's right.
I want to ask, how has your investigation changed? If you were to walk us through just like the way it was when you were a sergeant or a detective versus the what kind of tools and tricks you have now that make the investigation easier and more definitive and faster.
Well, back in the beginning of my career, you know, we went out to the crime scene. We looked for evidence there. We looked for the ballistics. We looked for fingerprints because that's what I was looking for back in the early 90s. We're looking for witnesses, mostly knocking at doors, seeing who called 911, saying, well, we know you called 911. What did you see? And we start building our case from there. Then we go back to the family of the victim and see, did he or she have a problem with anybody? What do you think this case is? And begin to move towards where we're going to go. Very hard to build your case. Now, we immediately respond and look for cameras. That's the first thing we're going to do. The other thing we
That's step one now.
Yeah. Step one.
You look cameras. To see where were the eyes.
The officers responding on the street will go for the cameras before we even get them. And they get there and say, we got this on video. Here it is.
Yeah.
And we're already moving because here's the offender right here.
And time matters here. The ability to act fast.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then you have access to cell phone location information.
So, well, we got to get a warrant for that.
Got to get a warrant. Okay.
But every person out there, and you know this, especially the young people, are walking around with a device in their hand that not only they can't keep out of their hand, but they're posting stuff on social media. They're putting their whole life out on social media. So when something happens, they get in an argument with somebody, it's there. So once we get into sometimes the victim's phone, we immediately see, all right,
yeah,
there's something here. So now we got to go start building our case that way. It also, if we asked it, will tell us a location. You know, we just had the case against the people that killed Sergeant Mendez at the airport. Yeah. And the one individual, when he was on the stand, said he kept turning his phone off because he didn't want us to track him, but he couldn't keep it off. So he turned it back on to make a call. He turned it back on to check something, and we could see where they were going.
Those digital breadcrumbs told the story, essentially.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
It's so... The difference, I think, between how a case is actually solved versus what we see on television. What do you think is the biggest difference, Deputy Commissioner Venora? Like, what is the biggest misconception, I suppose, about how a more, let's say, average murder case is solved?
Well, on TV, they take DNA off something, and by the time the commercial's over, they have it back.
Right.
That doesn't happen in real life. Yeah. So time, you know, we need time to build our case. We need time to process the evidence. We have a new forensic lab coming, but our forensic lab now does a lot of work for us. We get touch DNA off items that we could never even dream of being able to get touch DNA off of before. So it's very important that we preserve the evidence. If you've seen any of our crime scenes, you'll see an area with yellow tape, and then sometimes you'll see an area inside with red tape. That area is where we're going to go in and process something for DNA. Mm-hmm. Could be a gun, could be anything. But we'll touch DNA. You know, if you had your glove off when you touched it once, we could possibly get your DNA. Now, we get somebody to compare that to. You get a warrant. You get a sample. We can match up DNA. And that's another step we have moving towards processing you towards an offender.
Yeah, I got a dangerous talk on YouTube says just because they're arresting more people doesn't mean they are arresting the right people. So I want to sort of, you know, number one, just sort of explain what the clearance rate really means, Ellie, so people understand. And then I want to take a step and also if there's any concerns, like when you have this increase in the number of people being identified as suspects in cases, what concerns arise? So explain to us first what the number means in layman's terms.
Mm-hmm. Right. The clearance rate, arrest does not equal convictions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think the hope with more of these convictions and more of these cases being built around forensic evidence, around things that aren't witnesses. Witnesses can lie, right? Confessions can be, you know, we saw, you know, in the 80s, confessions being beaten out of people. And so the hope is that, okay, well, if this person's cell phone is there, if they went on Instagram Live and they talked about this, and we are building a case that doesn't involve any witness, involving no one that's lying, then hopefully that conviction is stronger and they do have the right person. You know, I've heard defense attorneys joke in the criminal courthouse before of like, oh, these cases are so boring, right? Because everything is just built on digital evidence and there's no witness up on the stand anymore who you can question.
The drama of those cases.
Right,
yeah.
Those are law and order cross-examinations. Uh-huh. That's not necessarily how it goes down these
days. But, but a lot of the cases that have been overturned in recent years are the older ones that were based almost often entirely on witness testimony, but we're seeing less of that now, anecdotally.
Yeah, and I wonder, Frank, if you,
I just wanted to clarify. When we investigate something, especially a murder, we have a team of DAs that are in the homicide unit of the DA's office that approve everything we're doing. So we get a warrant, we send it to them. They're as integral in the case as we are. In fact, the DA that worked the Kata Scott case with us was out with us multiple times when we were doing searches. When we eventually found her, she was standing right next to us. They're very, very involved in the case. They approve things as we move. So it's not just us building that probable cause. We're building it with them.
And I wonder, a quick follow-up to what Ali had to say, you know, do you have any concerns? Because when there's more attention on clearance, right, solving these cases, you know, really identifying suspects, making those arrests, do your officers, does your department feel the pressure to make things happen? Or does the fact that you have more tools at your disposal sort of make sure that everybody is almost like a traffic cop and make sure that you guys are doing it the right way?
Well, Commissioner Bethel's building this so that we have multiple, things working at the same time. Patrol, we're moving things faster than we ever did. The officers are assigned phones. So when we push information out, it ain't like come in and get the flyer. It's hitting their phone. It's hitting their computer in their car immediately. So they'll get a video. They'll snap a shot at the defender and whoom. And then we have an officer call and say, I know who that is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's how fast
we're
doing things.
So it's much more efficient.
Oh, yeah. It's moving at lightning speed.
And there's
also
been some stop gaps that the department has put in, you know, with some of those questionable convictions and the coercion of confessions. Right now every witness interview room has a camera. And so there's other...
We don't even write interviews anymore. We have them recorded. Mm-hmm. So you'll see the whole interview from beginning to end.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure that, you know, are there, and I want to go back, are there things that are in place that you feel make sure that there won't be some of the mistakes, the coercion, the, wrong individuals being arrested that... So that won't happen now? Are there things in place that you feel confident that will make sure that history won't repeat itself?
Absolutely. We have, our policy always evolves, even going back to Commissioner Ramsey's tenure here, where, he changed some things, 21st century policing, ensure that we're using the data that we have in this technology the right way. You know, there's a retention period for our video. There's a retention period for our body camera video that we hold. We don't keep it forever.
Yeah.
So we're putting some things in place to make sure that we do things the right way. As Ellie was saying, we video our confession. So nothing's happening in that room that you can't easily audit. We change the way holding on to witnesses and to offenders. If they're not charged within a period of time, there's a level of approval that's needed to let them stay there even longer. And then eventually they're let go, whether they're the right offender or not. If we have to build the case more, they get released.
Yeah. We want to hear from you this hour. Do you feel safer in Philadelphia with crime down and clearance rates up? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Let's read this comment from Matt, who says, Do I feel safer in Philly? No. Why? Because of you, a.k.a. the media. As long as TV, radio, newspapers, and the rest continue to grab emotions, ears, and eyeballs with if it bleeds, it leads, few will feel safe regardless of reality. Yeah. Sean has a similar comment, says, I do feel safer. The statistics are significant. People on social media tend to focus on crimes and act like we live in Philadelphia, but I generally feel safe in this city. Happy to hear about the clearance rates. Thank you, Matt and Sean. Keep those comments coming. Going back to how investigations used to work, there were documented cases of homicide investigators using coercion tactics and breaking the law in other ways. And I wonder, when your case really rests on witness testimony and getting someone to turn or getting something out of someone, I have to imagine that creates a sort of perverse incentive for the detectives. And I wonder if now you've been able to eliminate that perverse incentive. You've been able to tell your detectives, you don't need to lean on people so hard. And we're not going to promote you because you're the toughest person in the investigation room. We're going to promote you because you know how to use tech. We're going to promote you because you know how to, triangulate all this different type of evidence instead of just being good at working someone in a room? Does it change, in a sense, the type of investigator you're looking for?
Well, it does. It does. I mean, there's a testing process to become an investigator, but it absolutely does. The investigators I have today are way different than the 70s and 80s when you're talking about. I mean, some of the investigators I have today, we just promoted about 20 detectives a week ago or so. They're newer employees. You know, they understand technology. And a lot of these newer people, and I have three kids, they're not used to talking to people. My youngest is still 25, and he's in front of a screen even now. Yeah. So they're
there's
used
now
to being
a value
in front
to
of
that.
Screen.
There's a yes. value to that yeah. now.
They know technology, but do they know the techniques that those other people had? Which obviously, there's physical coercion is ridiculous. But I was in a room with some very good investigators who knew how to interrogate. And that technique is gone. I mean, we
still
have some
So you still need
people.
Both is what I'm hearing you say.
Sure.
You still need both. Even with all the great technology out there, you still need to be able to talk to someone and talk to a witness.
You still need that tip, right? We still need those tips coming in from the public. You still need that person on the street who's like, oh, I know who that is.
Yeah.
Or this is why they did that. And then that leads the detective
in the
right direction.
Yeah. And we went through that period, and it's still here a little bit, that no snitch. I'm not going to be the one cooperating. So sometimes the detectives, the officers have to use, you know, I'll come back and talk to you later when nobody's around, because they're afraid somebody's going to see them. And they're going to get marked in some way. So that's a problem. You do need people to lead you in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about the clearance rate and solving these crimes as a deterrent and how, you know, when you are able to identify a suspect and charge someone, the ripple effect. Can both of you sort of talk about the ripple effect that happens? Ellie, I know you talk to a lot of people who are co-victims of different types of crimes. What does that do when, you know, Frank Vannoy and his team are able to solve something?
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, shootings are contagious, right? When one person is shot, the odds of them either retaliating or then, you know, the shooter becoming another victim, it just leads to more shootings. And so when you're arresting that first shooter, it keeps, you know, the person in the family from wanting to get back themselves. It also deters others, right, with a message of accountability. We know that deterrence is huge, that if I think that if I go shoot this person, I'm going to get caught, the odds of me doing that will go down.
Yeah.
You know, it improves the relationship with the community, right? When the clearance rate is low, when homicides are not being solved, when shootings are not being solved, people feel like, well, my son doesn't matter. You know, why aren't the police here, you know, solving this case? And so when more of these cases are being solved, it does seem like anecdotally the relationship with the community and the police also improves.
Yeah, I've read criminologists say that the certainty of punishment is maybe even more important than the length or the severity of punishment, because when everyone in the community knows you're not getting away with it, they try less stuff. Do you agree, Deputy Commissioner Vannoy?
I do, and I try to push every arrest we make out, even if it's not the job that got all the attention when it happened.
Yeah.
We do our best to put out, doesn't always get carried, doesn't always get publicized, but we do our best to tell the story. But we made they made over 220 murder arrests this year alone. 220 murder arrests. That's a lot.
And when that sinks in on a community level, it can prevent future crime.
That's right.
And it must feel good for your department when you do all this work and you're actually able to make an arrest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's success. It's success. And whether, like you said in the beginning, what's the cause of this? Well, there's a lot of causes. Like I said, the young officer out there who knows how to go back and check the tag and go look at the video, and he gets us moving before we even start moving.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have a lot more to come on this topic. I have a question here from Jackson. I want to get to this on the other side of the break. Jackson says, how does the PPD fight temporary and most of the time expired license plates or blackout license plates? Because that can interfere with the license plate readers. We'll talk about that. We're also going to hear from someone who's still awaiting justice for the murder of a family member. Keep those calls and comments coming. 888-477-9499. Studio2@WHYY.org is the email address. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about what is driving the decades-high homicide clearance rate here in Philadelphia. And with us are Frank Venor, Deputy Commissioner of the Philadelphia Police Department, who is in charge of homicide investigations. We also have Ellie Rushing, criminal justice reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Our question for you at home, on the road, and elsewhere is this: do you feel safer in Philly with crime down and clearance rates up? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And now we want to bring in Brett Roman Williams, someone who is still looking for justice in his brother's killing. He's the board president of the Anti-Violence Partnership and is working on a documentary about Philadelphia families and co-victims of unsolved homicides. It's called Left in the Dark. Brett, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me, everyone. Thank you.
So just want to give a little background here. Your father, Brett, was shot and killed in the 90s, then your older brother shot and killed 20 years later. Yes. Your father's case was solved. Your brother's remains unsolved. I want to make sure I have that right. And I want you also to describe, I guess, the emotional discrepancy between having closure in one case and not in the other, how you kind of navigate, or how you can shed light on just how those cases feel different to you, given that they've had different outcomes in the criminal justice system.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that perspective and that question. When my father passed away, it was in 1996. I was 11 years old. And then when my brother was murdered, well, they both were murdered, but in 2016, I was 31 years old. So clearly you're talking about a child experiencing trauma through gun violence, as opposed to a full-grown adult experiencing that trauma. As a child, it was all up on my parents and how my family supported me, whether they took me to a grief counseling, which they didn't, because that just was something that we didn't process during that time. But as an adult, being that I did have that experience and I can take matters into my own responsibilities in hand and saying, look, I was the closest of kin to my brother's case, number one. And as the closest of kin, I was the person who was in communication with the detective, was in communication with the medical examiner's office, who received the resources that the city provides, such as the Anti-Violence Partnership of Philadelphia, which I was a client of. I just took it upon myself to say, hey, look, I know what I went through for 20 years with my father, going through adolescence, college. I don't want to go through that again. Yes, it's tough now because my brother's case is unsolved. That's the hard part to swallow. And he was murdered on our street block. So every day we go to our house, I'm thinking of that. I'm replaying that.
I want you to talk about what it feels, because I know that you work with a lot of people who are co-victims of gun violence and other crimes. What does it feel like to not know who is responsible for a crime like homicide, killing somebody you love so deeply?
It hurts. I've spoken to mothers, a lot of mothers, to be honest, because when you look at the statistics, it's a lot of young Black and brown men who are the victims of these homicides. So I see a lot of mothers in pain. They distrust the community. They want to leave Philadelphia. They become hypervigilant, meaning they're staying up all night trying to find out who killed their loved one, doing their own detective work. They start their own nonprofits while they're still healing, while they're still grieving. So there's also a process where they're encountering and being vicariously traumatized through other people's cases, because now they want to help and advocate. But at the same time, they're still trying to get their own justice. So it's a whole wave of emotions. And just to talk about another phrase that I like to use, is being left in the dark. Sometimes your community don't want to show up, as we've heard in this pod, because they don't want to be marked as a witness. So therefore, you're looking at your neighbors like, you know?
Yeah, the distrust that grows from that.
I'm curious, when it comes to your brother's killing, was there a point when it dawned on you that the answer wasn't coming, at least not in the short term, where you realized, I don't know if it was a month, a week, a year, where you're like, oh, wow, this could go on for a while? Do you remember ever thinking that, or was it kind of just like, wow, you woke up one day and it's been almost 10 years and it kind of snuck up on you?
Trying to think if it was an exact moment. I can't say there was an exact moment, but you know, you hear the phrase from watching TV, as we talked about, first 48.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
My personal experiences with my brother's case as detective, the communication was strong for about a week or so. And then the holiday season came around. My brother was murdered on October 27th. So, you know, once, you know, the holiday season comes around and then Christmas comes around, then it's New Year's, then that's when you start thinking like, dang, it's been 2 months now. And that's when you start calculating. And it eventually communications with the detective starts to subside, or it becomes less frequent.
Yeah, what does that mean? How often are you hearing from the detective in the beginning, at least in your case? And then when it subsides, I mean, how often are you still in contact with someone at the department? Like, what does subside look like in terms of the elapsed time between contacts?
So personally, I'll just speak from my experience. When it first happened, I was the person to walk up to the crime scene, introduce myself to the detective. I don't know where this came from, but my mind automatically went into solving the case.
Yeah.
I took pictures of the crime scene because they were still roping up the tape. And I took pictures of license plates, of things that looked suspicious. So I was very hypervigilant from the rip. And then speaking to my detective, it was very open, very open. The only thing was I had to wait till midnight because that's when my brother was murdered, around the midnight hour. So when my detective shift would start, I would have to wait till midnight to communicate. Mm. That was kind of complicated and frustrating because sometimes he may be out on the beat or on another case. Well, I'm trying to get in touch with him. I have to leave a message. I'll go to sleep and then have to wait for them to return the call. And in the early stages, they were happening. And then it just gradually stopped happening. And I know a lot of families experience that.
Yeah. And as we get ready to wrap up, Brett, I got to ask you, what does justice for your brother, for your family look like? And as you process that and explain that to us, what do you want people to know about families who never get their case cleared?
Well, justice for us, we've had, of course, the easiest answer for that is to have my brother back. But justice, I would say it's tough. We appreciate the technology and the advances that are happening. It's great to see the clearance rate at a high of, you know, previous years, from 50% or flipping a coin toss. But it still hurts when we see those statistics, because there's a whole bunch of families who were in that era of 2015, 2016, 17, up to 22, when Philly was at its peak. And even before then, I know families with cases that 16 years old, still unsolved. When we see these statistics, it's a hooray for the city and, you know, for the future and improvement. But in terms of how we feel currently, it's still something that we have to swallow and deal with. And it doesn't feel good to see. I kind of say you probably feel envious sometimes, because it's like, damn, that could have been my, why can my family have that? You know, or what does that feel like? I would say that's how I feel.
Can I ask you something? And look, feel free if you don't want to answer this, but do you still have hope that your brother's killer will be found and brought to justice?
Nah, I don't have hope, to be honest. I just continue to try to do work for the community, continue to advocate, speak on other people's behalf, you know, stay involved, vote, make sure that our voices are continuously heard. And that's what we have to do.
Yeah,
I'm at peace with that.
Thank you so much. That is Brett Roman Williams, who is still looking for justice in his brother's killing. He is the board president of the Anti-Violence Partnership, and he's working on a documentary about Philadelphia families and co-victims of unsolved homicides. Thank you so much for being here, Brett.
Thank you for having us.
As we listen to all of that, Frank Vanor, like, we know there's scores of people still waiting for some healing, some closure, some answer for a case going back, some cases going back decades. What is the process for trying to keep tabs on those cases,
cold cases,
these cold cases, and how much more can you do now?
So I'm going to talk a little bit about his complaint. I understand it completely.
Yeah.
It's unimaginable that he just falls off the chart. We're trying our best not to have that happen now. When I came back to the Detective Bureau as the chief in 2018, 19, I heard nothing but that complaint. I can't reach my detective. Now they don't understand that detective may be in court. Like he said, they work midnight to eight, but that's no excuse. Mm-hmm. So they tried lots of remedies to solve that. They gave them phones. They did different things. Commissioner Bethel hired somebody. We have our own victim advocates now. We have a whole team of victim advocates. So once you're the family member, you're assigned a detective, but you're also assigned an advocate. That's your contact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that advocate is the bridge to the homicide unit. It's also the bridge to our shooting investigations and our crash investigations when it deals with a fatal. They do everything they can to keep that family member informed, let them know what's going on with the case. They get briefed by the detectives. They brief them. If they want a meeting, they set that meeting up. So we're doing our best. Cold cases, though, very hard to manage. As you said, we have quite a few of them. But we do have a cold case group trying to look at some of them old cases through today's lenses. We are solving cold cases. Mm-hmm. I think we solved one from the early 90s this wow. year. So there's evidence there. Sometimes we got to grab it, look at it, and then put it through today's yeah. lens and see what we have.
Yeah.
Not everyone could be solved, but I'd certainly like to take a look at Brett's case to see where it is.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe the justice can be found. And so, Ellie, want to bring you back into the conversation because, you know, we talked about a lot of the good news. The clearance rate is up, but there are still hundreds of cases the Inquirer found from the surge of mm-hmm. gun violence that happened. Could you talk about that and what your investigation was able to uncover?
Sure. I mean, we found that between 2021 and 2023, there's still upwards of more than 800 cases that haven't
just
had
so
arrest.
Many. Yeah.
Right. The detectives at that point were in triage mode.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they were being assigned 10 to 15 cases each in each of those years, which is more than twice, you know, the recommended caseload from the Department of Justice. And I know that some are, you know, they're still going back to those cases, but the longer we get from that time, you know, from it happening, it becomes harder to solve.
Yeah.
I mentioned this question before the break. Jackson wanted to know about folks who obscure mm-hmm. their license plates, but I think it also brings up this larger question. We have new technology now. We have way more cameras. We have cell phone data, et cetera. Every time there's a new technology, criminals will start to devise ways to thwart that technology. But license plate blocking, what else are you seeing out there, Deputy Commissioner, that's emerging that you're worried about, that criminals are maybe starting to understand where the evidence is coming from and how to combat it?
Well, they try to cloak their tag. Sometimes they'll change the tag and then change it back. So if we have enough information about that particular car, we could look for it and try to find a pattern of life on it. So if they have the bad tag on it, it probably was on it more than once.
Yeah.
And maybe they parked it near their house. So every one of our cars has cameras on it that we could use as an LPR, a license plate reader. So even if the bad tag is there and it keeps parking there, that's probably where our person lives. Probably not the right tag, but it puts us on a place to go.
Mm.
Yeah. So there are ways around it. I mean, we try to train the officers what a bad paper tag is. Sometimes it's hard for me to explain because mm-hmm. it seems like they're just printing them. But there's other states that have legitimate paper tags. So you're waiting for your tag to come in. So there's certain ways they fasten them that we show the officers. I think New York put a great product together for the officers to show them every state and what their paper tags look like. Because some of them are just making them. I think they make them in their bedroom and they try to hang them on the
car. Yeah.
That's not really going to work.
And yeah. am I wrong that you can also, like, the license plate reader system is so advanced where you can actually just search by like car color and make and model sometimes?
It's looking for the tag. But,
okay.
But we have ways in our video where we could look for that particular type of car.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I love that. I want to ask you, Frank Benord, like, is there a concrete metric besides the clearance rate that you are hoping people sort of judge the PPD's work on? Because I know we've talked a lot about clearance rate because they have jumped up, but are there other things people should be looking at as well?
Well, I think you hit it on the head when you were talking to somebody out there in the public, is they want to feel safe. We want people to feel safe. So we try our best to push our good news out there, our good stories. I know if it bleeds, it leads. But we're yeah. trying to push by that. I was the PIO here when Commissioner Ramsey was here at the end of Commissioner Johnson's era. So I know how the media works. I know which story they're looking for. But we try to push past that to show we have a lot of really good stories here that we've done, arrests we've made, people we've saved, people we've done CPR on, and they're back in working. Stuff that's really important that we don't always make the news.
Yeah. Elliot, just as we wrap up, is there anything you found in your reporting? I know you were talking about this off mic a little bit in terms of the time it takes to solve a case, how critical that is, and how much the investigators have been able to speed up that timeline. I'm just curious for your thoughts on that as we get ready to close in about 45 seconds, the speed to sort of finding someone and issuing an arrest.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to look at how quickly police were making arrests because part of, you know, why the clearance rate has improved is because of math, right? With fewer killings overall, even fewer total arrests will boost that clearance rate. And so we wanted to say, well, are they making arrests quicker? And we found that they are. I mean, our analysis was through August, but we found that 31% of cases that were solved or that had an arrest through August had an arrest within 1 week.
Yeah.
3 years ago, that was only 15%.
So doubled. Wow. Mm-hmm. It's doubled. So it's not just the math equation has changed. The actual cases are getting solved faster and at a higher rate. Mm-hmm.
And that's probably because they have access to better evidence more quickly. Yep. They have cameras. The license plate readers. They have the cameras.
Well, thank you both so much for your insights this hour. That's Ellie Rushing, criminal justice reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Frank Vanor, Philadelphia Police Deputy Commissioner in charge of homicide investigations. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, Deputy Commissioner Citizen Dave on Facebook says, I think perception is still lagging reality. However, I feel relatively safe, but I still stay aware of my surroundings. So people here are saying they do feel safe. Thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Our bank, Satina Calique, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.